Welcome back to Firewall. As usual, I'm your host, Bradley Tusk. My guest today is Tricia Romano. Tricia has written a great oral history of the Village Voice. It's called The Freaks Came Out to Write, The Definitive History of the Village Voice, The Radical Paper That Changed American Culture. Tricia, thank you so much for joining us. Really happy to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me.
So oral histories are so fun, right? And I think that readers really appreciate it. I always really appreciate it. Did you kind of know going in this is going to be an oral history, or did that kind of evolve at some point as you were figuring this book out?
No, it was pitched as an oral history, which, you know, maybe I regretted later because it's the hardest form, I think, to do. It's the most labor intensive and it's the easiest to read, but the other end of it is really hard.
Yeah. So like when you were conceiving it, obviously you made a cast of characters and, you know, not everyone is even still alive. Right. Did you sort of figure out first, like, okay, I know all of these different people will definitely participate, and then decide to do an oral history? Or is it more like, hey, you know, this book's getting published. Do you want to be in it?
No. I mean, it was a little bit of both because before I, you know, when I was pitching it, I had to write a proposal. And so I, you know, surveyed about 10 or 12 people that I had worked with and, you know, did a couple of sample chapters. And then once it was, you know, that once we had a deal, you know, there's this Facebook page of voice people. And I, you know, went on there and I said, this is what I'm doing. I would love for you to participate. And, you know, a couple of people reached out to me and they were sort of the first introductions to like the early people. And so that's how it went. It just evolved from there. And there were some people that I knew that I absolutely had to talk to, but then there were people I didn't know at all. Especially, you know, from obviously the 50s, 60s, 70s, I wasn't there until the late 90s. So, very different generation.
So, you know, just for our kind of younger listeners who may not be familiar with The Voice, if you take like, you know, a minute, what was The Voice, or I guess kind of is, but really, what was The Voice and why did it matter so much?
Well, I think it's hard for somebody who's 20 who has the world at their fingertips to understand. But, you know, back in the day, 1955, like you couldn't get your hands on just about anything. You had to really seek it out. The print was finite. And The Voice was started by three people who lived in Greenwich Village during that time when like beat poets were hot and like jazz was starting to burn up and all that stuff was happening, Off-Broadway was happening. And they were like, well, we don't see anything that reflects the lifestyle that we live down here and, you know, or the politics that we're interested in. And so they started it, one of them, of course, being Norman Mailer, the other two, Dan Fancher, Ed Fancher and Dan Wolf. And they just started it on, you know, like almost like a class project. You know, they barely knew what they were doing. It was week to week scrounging by. They didn't make any money for, you know, really a decade. And it quickly became the voice of downtown. And anybody that is, now you know, like if you think about like Patti Smith's Just Kids or whatever, there's always somebody somewhere in like Kansas who, you know, wants to get out. And The Voice kind of reflected that lifestyle to other people out in the country that were so far away from that and didn't have access to, you know, underground cultures or subcultures. And so, you know, The Voice was so important because it was covering stuff that nobody else was way before everybody else was.
And like, to a certain extent, you know, was it like in a way a precursor for the internet in the sense of, you know, you had kind of mainstream media and they decided what was proper and what deserved coverage and what didn't. And The Voice kind of redefined that completely. And it ultimately sort of, even though the internet in some ways probably killed The Voice and just killed a lot of alternative papers, it kind of like was a sign of like, hey, there's an audience out there for all kinds of stuff that isn't necessarily what the New York Times tells us we're supposed to like.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the things that The Voice was so good at was just opening its doors to anybody that wanted to write. And, you know, so it wasn't the same gatekeeping system that you would see at the New York Times, which basically would only hire like Ivy League people and people with journalism degrees or pedigrees of some kind. And The Voice was sort of like, that was a strike against you. And so, you know, they hired people like Jonas Mekas, who was a Lithuanian refugee, and he was interested in avant-garde film. Nobody was writing about avant-garde film, and he was a director filmmaker himself. He had, you know, loft parties where he screened Andy Warhol's films, and he wrote in a first person about the films that he liked and the films that he saw in his screening. And so did, you know, Jerry Tolmer. So did later Richard Goldstein. And people weren't really writing in the first person in the 50s and 60s in newsprint. Like, it just wasn't done. It was very objective, very, you know, just a fax, ma'am. And The Voice advantage was that it puts you on the ground from the point of view of the people who were there at whatever event or at whatever, you know, thing they were covering.
Right. So what like the original Substack. So like, what was the mainstream reaction to The Voice when it launched? Did like the Times and the Herald Tribune and all those New York papers back then just kind of look down their nose at it?
I mean, I don't think they even really realized it exists for a while. You know, I think it was only until the newspaper strike of 62-63, where almost all the newspapers in New York stopped publishing because they were all part of a union, and The Voice was not unionized because it was, you know, barely like 5 people or something. And, you know, you have to think like, okay, there's no internet. You can't go online and just see what's going on. Like, there's only one thing in the paper in the city that you can buy that tells you what's happening. And that was the Village Voice at that point. So that was a very big turning point for the paper, because then people that, you know, may never have picked it up because they didn't know about it, or maybe they thought it was like the commie paper, they started reading it and realizing that it was, you know, valuable or interesting and
I love
kind
that
of weird.
That the commie paper takes advantage of a work stoppage at the mainstream papers, and that becomes its breakthrough.
The commie paper is more opportunistic entrepreneurial than the
unionized
capitalist paper. Yeah, wow. Exactly.
Yeah. One of the many sort of little strange twists and turns of the Village Voice story.
Trisha, what would your Mount Rushmore be for? I mean, The Voice is sort of famous now for having, and you obviously you talked about so many of them, so many incredible writers, reporters, columnists, editors. If you had to say, like, this is the pantheon, you know, now that you did all this work and all this thinking, all this writing, who would be on it for you?
Oh, let's see. It's so hard because
you could have more than 4 if you want.
I mean, think of it in terms of like who do you go back and read? You know, like there's these people sort of like in the moment were important, but who kind of stands out in almost like historic terms?
I mean, I think you've got Greg Tate, the cultural critic who died a couple of years ago, and his. You know, writing and his style and his voice was so unique and groundbreaking. And, you know, nobody was writing like him when he showed up in the early 80s. I think somebody like Vivian Gornick, who's one of the 70s, you know, second wave feminists that was writing regularly in The Voice, is somebody that I would put in there. And, you know, we've got the front of the book, and you've got people like, I would say, Wayne Barrett, who...
Yeah, we're going to talk about Wayne Barrett in a second.
Who covered Trump, you know, before anybody, you know, and had his number really early. I would put Wayne in there. You know, you also have Nat Hentoff. And then from the back of the book, I would say you'd need Richard Goldstein. I mean, it's so hard because, you know, that was the thing. The Voice was just like... octopus, right? It had so many tentacles, and everybody was excellent. I mean, you also had Michael Feingold, who's like the long time theater critic, who was a lion, you know, and he just died. It was very sad. just so many, and there's so many generations, you know. And they're all, like, there are some people that a lot of people don't know about. I think Hugh just sent me a note. I'm forgetting his Michael. What is his name?
His name is Michael Sorkin.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I've had a couple of people bring him up. I didn't know about him. Nobody mentioned him. Michael Musso is also, you know, very, and he was one, he's probably, I think Michael Musso is probably the most known voice writer among anybody who's like in their 20s or 30s. You know what I mean? Like, I think like he probably is the biggest name recognition. I mean, he was a groundbreaking columnist, even just for being wildly out and writing about drag queens and RuPaul and all that stuff way before. And then of course he started writing about ACT UP and AIDS, which, you know, gossip columns are supposed to be light and fun, but, you know, he didn't give a fuck. You know?
So speaking of that, you know, you always think of The Voice as this very kind of progressive, left-leaning newspaper. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that you told the readers is that The Voice's history on gay issues and gay rights is actually not something to be particularly proud of at all. You know, how did that evolve, and why do you think it was that way?
I mean, I think they're learning on the job, right? It's like Shades of Grey. Like, I think their hearts were in the right place, you know? But, you know, when Stonewall happened, it was two straight guys that were writing it. And they were open-minded straight guys, but they, you know, still were steeped in, you know, decades of learned homophobia. And so was the whole staff.
And they didn't take it that seriously, right? I mean, they kind of went out there and they... A number of people make that an interesting point that the gay bars were all owned by the mob. So people viewed them in the village as kind of like almost like a nuisance or something, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think like they all knew how corrupt the whole thing was, right? And it was just sort of a fact of like, I think like Richard Goldstein, who was not yet out and later became, you know, one of the most vocal out editors at The Voice. He was like, there were riots every day. You know, we could watch like protests and riots every day because it was the 60s. And, you know, I think, you know, they were sort of like, oh, here we go. It's right under our door. We might as well cover it, you know. But I think, you know, in hindsight, they realized it was a big deal, especially since people started organizing right after it. Like Jim Forrett was organizing. And, you know, they were protested against, The Voice was, for, you know, not using the word gay in the paper. And they were, you know, protested for their lead, and sort of like they had to learn, just like anybody else, but they were first to learn that. And, you know, they led that way. Like, they were a standard to which other papers were going to be measured against on how you talk, use that, what language you use to talk about gay people. And, you know, even during AIDS, I think they were not hitting it as hard as they could have earlier. And that was something that Larry Kramer backed up, you know, went after them for, particularly Richard, because that, by that time, Richard was out. And, you know, part of it was like, The Voice is different than other papers in that they don't, you know, because they're not like this beacon of objectivity, people are writing about their life. And so it's, how do you cover this without it getting too intertwined into your personal, I guess, biases in that way? Because it was, nobody knew anything in 1981, 82, 83, 84. They knew nothing. And all those quack cures were being flaunted. And, you know, The Voice didn't want to write about those because it was not proven, right? It, you know, they didn't want to be responsible for writing about things that were, you know, iffy. So, you know, it took them a while. And then I think by the mid 80s, they were much stronger on it. And certainly by the time I was there, Mark Schuff's won a Pulitzer for the paper for his AIDS in Africa series.
And, you know, interestingly, Rupert Murdoch owned the paper at one point, but kind of didn't in any way kind of turn it into what like the New York Post is.
No, not at all.
How did that happen? How did it not fall kind of, you know, prey to the most, like most papers that he owns?
I I think he just realized that the formula that The Voice was worked for it, and to mess with it was to, you know, ruin his own investment. And it's so he actually put money into it and grew it, and then he made money off of it when he sold it.
Yeah, and I guess that's how he's treated the Wall Street Journal, other than the crazy editorial page.
Well, you know, Wall Street Journal, their op-ed is more right-leaning.
Yeah.
But like, if you read their features and their news, it's pretty, you know, I read it. I enjoy it. I read it. I have Apple News or whatever, so I get their stories, and I read a lot of their stories, and I'm not at all like, ew, Rupert Murdoch is mine. Right. You know?
So he knows when to leave a good thing alone. One of the things that I found so fascinating was sort of the amount of internecine warfare within The Voice in terms of the writers and the editors and everything like that. So, for example, you know, you mentioned the story of Pete Hamill defending Bernie Getz. Was that a feature or a bug of the culture that everyone was at war with each other?
Both. I mean, I think that gave it its, like, energy, right? Like, everybody, like, part of the thing of being a paper where people write about their passions or things that they're deeply involved in or, you know, care about is that everybody's going to have their own idea of what that is. You know, everyone also believes that their thing is the best thing or the most important thing. And so that just creates a lot of friction and tension and energy and infighting because, you know, one group thinks that they're not getting enough attention on the cover or they're not getting enough pages. Another group thinks like, well, our stuff is way more important because we're news writers or we're culture writers, you know? And so it's kind of good because I always say I was an editor at The Stranger for a hot minute and Seattle. And, you know, you can't have a paper that's just all one thing. It's boring. You need that, the front and the back, and you need that friction and fighting. And they were also, you know, hilarious. And that's like the hilarious voice tradition of like going at each other in print and then also in like the letters section. I mean, just incredible, right?
Well,
I mean,
if you were going to make like a mini series about like one conflict within The Voice, who would you pick?
Oh God, there's two. I would either do the 10-year anniversary of gay rights at Stonewall. It was 1979, and it was their first gay issue. And Jules Pfeiffer had a cartoon that he wanted to submit that was pretty offensive, you know, talking about like, you can't say this anymore. You can't say that anymore. I guess I'll go back to saying the N word. And
yeah, I found that shocking. I remember that I
mean, yeah, it's crazy.
And it did get published, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. They published it. So they decided after like going to some civil rights leaders and whatnot is okay. You can't censor Jules Pfeiffer. It would be like insane. And
Jules Pfeiffer, it should be mentioned, was the other Pulitzer winner besides Mark Schuff. So the two Pulitzers. Oh, one of three. Okay.
He's one of three. Teresa Carpenter won the first one.
Oh, that's right.
they said, we're not going to put it in this section where, you know, that's like gay life, the gay pride issue. We'll put it like in the front or wherever, like by the letters. And so they published it and people were outraged. Like people on the staff were outraged. There was like 13 people that signed a letter of protest saying like this has gone too far. It's not so disrespectful. And then of course, like Nat Hentschoff and I think Alexander Coburn like piped in and they wrote columns about how the Village Voice 13 were censorship or for censorship. I mean, this went back and forth, like it raged the whole summer.
Okay, so that's one. What's your second show then?
The second one would be, I think, the rise of hip hop and the tensions in the newsroom between Stanley Crouch and Harry Allen. And who Harry Allen was a hip hop writer. He calls himself the hip hop assassin, I think, media assassin still. And he was really there on the, you know, front lines for hip hop very early. And he was friends with Chuck D, and he's part of some recordings on Public Enemy. I think he's on Don't Believe the Hype. and then, you know, Stanley Crouch is just like venerable black columnist who was into more traditional jazz, more conservative, and he just thought hip hop was disgusting and a bad look for black people. And Stanley was very combative with everybody. He had gotten verbal altercations and near physical altercations, and he like hit or, you know, pushed Harry Allen into a closet and had to be like dragged out, and then he was eventually fired.
Oh, he didn't punch him. He did punch him, right?
Or no? He punched him, I believe. Yeah, him, right? Yeah. It's, but like it wasn't like it was over fast, right? You know, and then, you know, he was fired after that. And then,
Wait,
he
Bradley,
became,
you have a question about this?
Well, right? just thinking about, like, you know, on one hand, you're describing all this creative tension that led to really interesting content for the readers. And yet, yeah, a complicated workplace that I think today wouldn't survive a week, right? And by the way, I mean, generally, that's good, right? We don't want workplaces filled with abuse and conflict and fighting. But like, given the way that our culture has evolved, although I would argue generally in this case for the better, would you say that it's almost hard to see another voice ever really coming to life
simply because
we don't have that?
This generation, the younger generation, they cry if you look at them meanly. So no, it could never happen.
Well, let me ask you, Tricia. So you're talking to these people years later, and the question is there some kind of lasting trauma that any of them feel? It does come across a little bit. Some of the disputes don't feel settled completely.
No. I think the older writers from the 60s, 70s, and 80s really have they still have those grudges, and you know, some of it was like very personal, you know, some of it is just ego, and some people are like, oh, whatever, you know. I think there was more at stake in the 60s, 70s, and 80s because the platform was bigger, it was a newer sort of thing, the stuff that they were talking about was more groundbreaking. You know, by the time you get into the 90s, like the voices, you know, sort of hold on everything, on culture, had slipped.
So, you know, by writing this oral history, you've also kind of written just that oral history of New York City in the second half of the 20th century.
Yeah.
Who would you say, in your view, were the most consequential figures, good, bad, or I think in reality, most of the answer is going to be mixed, of that period?
Of New York?
Yeah, of New York broadly. So not the people at The Voice per se, but like, as you know, based on all of their coverage and everything that happened.
I mean,
like, if you went back and said, these are the, like, let's just say we're at a dinner party and you got to invite the most consequential people in New York City history in the second half of the 20th century.
I mean,
in any field, who would you pick?
I would say you got to have Ed Koch.
Yeah.
You probably have to have Rudy Giuliani. I don't know if I would include Trump because he wasn't really consequential in New York, was he? I mean, he was kind of
kind of a joke.
In New York.
Well, what about cultural figures like those are big top line guys, which is what Bradley asked. But I'm curious.
No, I mean also like you know, was there one particular artist or writer or cultural figure or whatever it is?
I don't think there's one person, sort of a collection, but I think like CBGB's, all the bands that came out of CBGB's in that late 70s period.
So they'll be the entertainment at the dinner.
Yeah. That would be great.
David Byrne,
all of them. He's still with us, thankfully. And I think that you would have, you know, oh, who would I put in the film or theater world?
The stuff on Spike Lee is pretty good. I mean,
Spike Lee is great. Yeah, Spike Lee and Chuck D and Public Enemy. I would put them in there for sure. I'm very music biased. Can you tell?
Yeah, that's not a bad thing at all.
Well, I'm wondering if who of the political figures at The Voice fixed on that might not be as well remembered. just trying to think of who that would even be. I mean, they didn't go after like Abe Beam or anything, or John Lindsay in some particular way, did they? Like,
I think they, Mary Nichols might have gone after
Mary Nichols.
Lindsay.
She's a great story. Yeah.
She did go after Lindsay after she worked for him.
Oh, right. Right. Turns on him.
But, you know, she also, I guess the other person I would put in that dinner party is probably Robert Moses and Robert Caro.
Yeah.
They'd probably get in an argument of some kind.
Yeah,
that would make it fun. And I guess Koch covers the whole municipal crisis in the 70s. I guess you could throw Ravitch or Lowett in there too, but he covers it. And so like if there's one reporter that you could only have like one reporter that you would read for the rest of your life from The Voice, who is your favorite writer?
Like reporter, like investigator?
Yeah, whoever. Anyone. It could be a columnist, cultural news, whatever.
I would say Richard Goldstein.
How come?
He is, one, just such an amazing, beautiful writer, but also he's like a generalist in that he can cover and write about just about anything. He can, you know, whether it's AIDS and reporting on AIDS, or it's writing about music and pop culture, or it's writing about current events, like news, breaking news. The way he writes, I think, is just, it's so engaging, and it's so, like, he's also very funny. Like, I think I quote his Talking Heads review in the book.
You totally quote that. No, it's a great... Yeah. I think I actually sent that to somebody because it's sort of borderline not complimentary about David Byrne himself, even though he loved the band. Like,
He loved
it. You sent it to me.
Did I send it to you?
Yeah.
I have the entire thing. Like, I transcribed it and like put it in my, and I posted it somewhere because the whole thing is just amazing. It's so good and it's so funny, and it's so, the other thing is, his writing is like very visually evocative. I felt like it was like I can picture what he was describing.
So distinctive and personal too. Like it's very, very Village Voice. And Richard worked there forever, right? Like, I mean,
forever.
He was there for like 30 years or something.
Something like that. I think he first came in 66 when he did the column. And then
was he there when you were there?
Yes.
Yeah.
And not for a very long time. I think we only overlapped like 2-3 years. And when I was an intern, actually, I interned with Frank Owen, who was the nightlife reporter, investigative writer. And he and I worked on a story together. And my very first Village Voice side-by-side edit was with Frank and Richard Goldstein, and watching Richard Goldstein work, and I was like,
Felt like you were in the big leagues.
I was just in awe. Well, because he was, what was so, no one does this. I don't know if anyone ever did it before, but no one does this now, certainly. But we sat side by side in front of the computer and went through every single line. And you know, if he was going to delete a sentence or change the phrasing, he'd be like, how about we do this way? And then you would agree, or you would like kind of collaborate on how to change it. And, you know, Frank turned in 2,500 words. And I remember we had to turn in 15 and he got it down, and he never did anything like cutting a whole paragraph or like nothing was cut. Like none of the substance of it was cut. And I was in awe. I was like, wow. So that's old school.
Yeah.
So old school.
The three of us are roughly in the same age bracket. And The Voice, to me, I remember when I was younger, had sort of dual roles, right? So yes, it was this place for cultural information and criticism and all of that and alternative views. It was also the place to find out about apartments, right? And
about
like,
what apartments? Oh, yeah.
I mean, Did you find an apartment there, Bradley?
I think through The Voice, I might've found an apartment at some point. All so I guess the question is like, how, because, you know, if you were to ask people, I think going back decades, you know, what role did The Voice play in your life? I mean, even though they're probably not thinking about it, like, I think how they figured out where to live was a big piece of it. How important was that both to the, like, what the paper was, but also to its economics?
I mean, very, it turned out. I mean, There's a line I think Bill Bastone has where he's like, we're all fighting about the front end of, you know, front of the book, back of the book, fighting for the cover space and thinking we're the most important hot shits. But really, nobody had more pull than the people who had the classifieds. Like those, that's what people were there for. You know, people used to line up on Astor Place Tuesday night before, yeah. you know, to get the first copies off the press. Get the jump on the apartments,
yeah.
And to get the jump on the apartments, and you know, it's so competitive, and you know, there's so few apartments available in New York. So that was like the thing for decades. And
so then tie that to then sort of how the paper ultimately its demise, because it kind of reflects both print demise broadly and
I mean, it's the canary in the coal mine. So he doesn't like it when we say this, but you know, Craigslist really undid especially alt weeklies, because most alt weeklies were free. Voice had gone free in 1994, so it had no subscription income anymore, except for probably people who were sending away for it far away. But, you know, I can't imagine that was enough. And so the classifieds were the bulk of their financial income, and they were very cheap to create, you know, not like the big visual ads, right, color ads. And, you know, it made the paper really thick. It subsidized everybody, everything. And when Craigslist comes along right around 9/11 in New York and takes out the middleman, like you can just post your ad directly to the site. It's free. It's fast. You don't have to wait a week to see them. You can just see it any day. You can just refresh it 20 times a day and see new stuff. It really, you know, cut the Voice and all these alt weeklies off at the knees. And, you know, Craigslist could do this because he doesn't have overhead. Like, there's not a huge staff of people that he has to pay. But the Voice, you know, they could have started doing something similar, but they would have probably tank themselves even sooner. And I don't know what the answer is for the media.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone's still struggling to figure that out.
Well, but what's interesting is just to link that to what you were talking about earlier, which is the sitting side by side, right? So that that experience, that process, is linked to the classifieds, to people finding apartments, to like the centrality of the Voice as a commercial venture. And once the commercial venture starts to fade, the sort of editorial stuff goes with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like sort of a vicious cycle, right? Like I see this a lot in local newspapers, regional newspapers, you know, they're not making enough money. So they cut like, however many people, 100 people or 50 people or 20 people, whatever the rate is for their paper. And then what's inside it is more shoddy. Like it becomes like there's less copywriters, fewer copywriters, copy editors, there's fewer editors. There's the writers have to produce more faster, and they have to produce for several different mediums. They have to do online. They have to do the print posts. I mean, you know, I think about like our time at the Voice before the internet. it is hilarious. We wrote one column a week, 800 to 1200 words, and maybe some listings, and maybe worked on like a feature in the background for like a month.
What'd you do all that?
I mean, you know, you go out into the world. You don't sit on your computer, because that wasn't even like really
there was nothing to do on your computer.
Not really.
Word processor. And
word processor. And you go out, you know, I would go out every night and find stories, and you know, other people were going out during the day, and you know, talking. I mean, they were doing their job, but that's why it was so much better. If you look at like the work that was produced, the Voice also had like a crazy amount of copy reads. We had two copy reads, a proofreader, and a fact-checking read, plus the editor, plus the top editor. I mean, it was like you know, people, I have friends now, they're like, everything is so shoddy, there's so many typos. I'm like, I'm sorry, but I don't feel like she gets really mad about it. And I'm like, you don't understand what has happened. Like, we're lucky if we get a copy editor to read our stuff now. And so mistakes are going to happen. And readers can feel that. I think they can feel that it's just getting weaker and weaker and more shoddy. And so what happens is everybody just gravitates towards the really big papers, and they're the ones that get all the money. And then your local news is shriveling up.
Right.
And it's really dangerous for our democracy, you know, because most of the democracy, most of the change is really happening at the local and state level, you know, and city hall and all that stuff. And
yep.
You don't have people really dedicated to doing that, and certainly TV news isn't doing it, then you don't have a very informed population.
Nope. Who also doesn't vote in local elections to begin with. So then last question, if I said to you, okay, you're in charge of architecting the voices comeback, and you can take whatever form you want, what would you do?
Oh, it would probably just have to be online. And I would probably, let's see. I don't know if I would do it how, like, there's some people that are doing stuff that's like a collective, where they're, it's almost like a Substack with like a front page where people write their own stuff and they post to it. You know, they kind of, I guess, what do you call it, curate it. And maybe I would do something like that, or I would just do straight up website and, you know, try and get.
But which would you lean into? Like, what's more important? The sort of, because the two main pieces of The Voice are the news and the sort of culture. And there are arguments for both, right? Why you'd want a really great news section that does some of the things that like are going undone these days, or a culture section that's way more intense and personal and revives some of those values. Which is the thing that it needs?
I think you have to have both.
Right.
It's not The Voice without both.
Right.
It's just not, you know, and I think there are lots of online that focus hard news. And, you know, I think The City is one, and Hellgate and is another. And, you know, there's a couple of them that are really doing it. But I think the balance of the two, the whole thing about The Voice is that it was your guide to life, whatever that life you wanted, that you cared about. Like, it was your, you picked it up and you could read about what was happening in your city politics with your criminal politician. And then you could go to the back of the book and read about what was the most important thing to read about in culture, music, film, theater. You know, you could find out what to do that weekend, and then you could go get your job in your apartment and maybe find your girlfriend or boyfriend. You know, it was like a whole package in your hands of, you know, your life. Like, how to live.
Yeah. That seems like a good place to stop.
Yeah. So just again, the book's called The Freaks Came Out to Write, The Definitive History of the Village Voice, the radical paper that changed American culture. Trisha, thank you so much for joining us, and highly encourage all the listeners to pick up a copy. I think you'd really enjoy it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Firewall is recorded at my bookstore, P&T Knitwear, located at 180 Orchard Street on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. We'd love to hear from you with questions, feedbacks, or idea for a guest. Just email me at bradley@firewall.media or find me on LinkedIn. And to keep up with what's on my mind and my latest writing, please follow my new Substack at bradleytuss.substack.com. Thanks again for listening.